Welcome to today's Indiana Chamber of Commerce Policy Issue Conference Call, hosted by Mr. Tom Schumann. During the presentation, all lines will be in a listen-only mode. If you have a question at any point during today's presentation, please press 01. Again, to ask a question, press 01 at any time. And thank you for your attention. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to your host, Mr. Tom Schumann.
Thank you and welcome on this first Friday of April of 2017. As we've done in recent months, we've been highlighting activity and progress in the Indiana General Assembly session. Today's call takes on a little more urgency as we've just passed the deadlines for the second half of the session. We have 2 weeks remaining before the expected closure of the 2017 General Assembly session. As mentioned, you can weigh in at any time during our call, simply hitting 01 on your phone, or you may tweet at Indiana Chamber any questions, and we'll be sure to address those. We'll start off with some of the chamber priorities that you've heard about in recent months, but plenty of action on all of those. We'll lead off with the infrastructure and road transportation. You'll see this afternoon in our legislative report some of the differences between the House and the Senate versions. Not unexpected that they would have different approaches to this, but Mark Lawrence, we'll turn it over to you to kind of describe where we're at this point and what we might expect to happen in these final 2 weeks.
Thank you, Tom. Good morning. The good news is the Senate did pass the road funding bill, House Bill 1002, 34-13 vote, and we were pleased about that. And I just define it by saying that there are now two versions of the bill that have been passed, so certainly the will of the legislature to get something significant done, we're pleased about that. Thought I'd just highlight just a couple of major differences between the two bills. The House bill is a little more ambitious in what it would raise on average per year, about $1.1 billion a year, which is pretty close to the amount that was identified for the need of our roads over the next 10 to 20 years, what we need to do to finish what we've completed, do a better job of maintaining our current roads, possibly adding additional roads. The Senate bill is less than that. It's $672 million a year. Couple major differences that the sales tax collected on fuel sales that were in the House bill, which is well over $300 million, that was in the House version, not in the Senate version. The House version had a $15 registration fee for all cars, that's every year, and $150 for electric cars. Senate kept that, but they added in $75 for hybrids, which the chamber supported. And if you want to buy a new set of tires fairly soon, I'd do it sooner than later unless you want to pay on the road tax. The Senate version had a $5 per new tire fee, excise fee, added to the current 25 cents. Another big difference is that the House version requires the Indiana Department of Transportation to seek a federal waiver for tolling along a major interstate. The Senate version says they may do it with the governor starting that process. So one is a shall, House, Senate is a may. And those are largely the big differences. They've already announced the conference committee on this, which is going to be held Monday afternoon. So out of the gate, I think they want to get this going. I think it's going to be a multi-session conference committee, but we're very pleased on the progress so far.
Well, that gives us an opportunity, and Kevin Brenninger, I'll ask you to follow up again for many of our listeners on the phone. Give a brief explanation of the conference committee. Mark mentioned there's a hearing on Monday. We know there's, I believe, a required public hearing, but we also know that much of the work takes place during these last 2 weeks behind the scenes.
Sure. The process is that when a bill passes the House and Senate, but in different forms, when it comes back to the original author of the bill, he or she essentially gets to decide whether they agree with the changes that were made in the second house or if they disagree. If they agree, they file a motion to concur. The first house votes on those changes, and if they adopt them, then the bill goes to the governor. If they disagree, they file a motion to dissent. And then at that point, a four-person conference committee is appointed by the Speaker of the House and the President Pro Tem of the Senate, two members each, typically one member from each of the four caucuses, although that doesn't have to be the case. And then, again, typically the original author of the bill serves as the chairman of the conference committee, and those four individuals get together and try to work out the differences between the House and Senate passed version and come up with a unified version that can then be taken back to the House and Senate and voted on, so that ultimately the House and Senate have to vote and adopt the exact same version of a bill before it can go down to the governor to be hopefully signed.
Two follow-up questions, Mark and Kevin. Mark, do we know who the conferees are on this bill? I wouldn't expect any surprises. And the second question is related to, we talked about some of the differences. What, if anything, do we believe will be the most contentious sticking point in getting to this legislation, the final legislation?
I'll answer the second part of your question first. I think the funding on the sales tax will end up being a big point of contention negotiation, and I also think the tolling will be a big issue too. That tends to be a very political aspect of it, and I guess it's maybe not in my backyard kind of a thing. If you are on either I-60 or I-70 corridor or your district's there, probably you're hearing from members or you know, citizens in your district that we don't want to toll the road that we're used to driving on for free and so forth. It'll take some education to get that done.
And it's important to note to the listeners that the Senate, and in particular Senator Kinley, are not talking about just putting tolls on the existing four-lane highways. What they're talking about is adding lanes and making, in particular, I-65 and I-70, six lanes throughout the entire state, which is arguably very desperately needed because of the level of traffic volume and congestion, and the tolling would be in conjunction with adding those additional lanes and, of course, all the bridges that would come along with taking those highways from four lanes to six lanes throughout the state. But I would agree with Mark. Those are the two areas of contention. The Senate seems pretty dead set on not transferring the sales tax on fuel over to the road funding. They feel like the sales tax on everything funds the state general fund and its general operations, including schools, et cetera. And at least right now, they seem pretty locked in on that. But that will be a point of debate and contention in this conference committee discussion.
And while this is HB 1002 and not our budget bill, a biannual budget bill, it really, with the financial implications involved, is it fair to say the key players are those fiscal leaders in both the House?
Yeah, they are. I just counted up the number of not only the conferees, the four basic conferees, but the advisors. There are a total of 16 people, so the better question may be who isn't on that. But now...
The four conferees...
Four conferees.
...that have the authority to either sign or not sign a conference committee report. The others are there to provide some input and moral support for their caucuses' conferees. But it's also safe to say that these two bills are very much intertwined, and that's why you have the same fiscal leaders, as Mark points out, serving as conferees and advisors on these two bills.
So the four conferees are, from the House side, it's the bill's author, Ed Soliday, and then he's a Republican, Dan Forrestal, who is the Democrat House conferee. On the Senate side, it's Mike Kreider, and who's a Republican, and Karen Talion, who's a Democrat.
All right. Thank you, Mark and Kevin. Let's turn to... education issues and pre-K expansion has been somewhat quiet publicly in the last few weeks as activity took place a little earlier in the second half of the session. But safe to assume there's probably plenty going on behind the scenes. Carol Auslander, give us a bit of an overview of where pre-K expansion stands at this point.
Well, I think it's safe to say that pretty much every substantive education bill right now is passed, and every single one of them is heading to conference. So everything is moving forward, which is good, but a lot of any bill that's in its format right now, education-wise, is up in the air because things will dramatically change in conference committees over the next few weeks, including the pre-K bill. The moving vehicle for this, in the first half of session, we had two bills, the House first, Senate version, which were pretty substantially different, but the House bill, when it moved over to the Senate, became the moving vehicle for the second half of session, where the Senate stripped out the existing language that the House had put in and put in their own language. But now it heads back to the House, and the Chairman Boehning, the lead author for the bill, has dissented, so it is going to conference committee. And it goes back to him, and he gets to be the chairman of the conference committee. We are working with both the House and the Senate leaders, as well as the authors and sponsors, to try to find some common ground. I think that there is some common ground. I think we will get a pre-K expansion bill. The question will really be what the revenue forecast looks like when it's announced next week as to how much funding will be available for this. The governor's office has been publicly saying they want to double the number of kids. We are hoping that we can go even past that. But again, how far we can go with this bill all depends on the dollars that can be allocated to it. But we're hoping that we will be able to make a bigger expansion and a bigger footprint on the pilot program within the Indiana for more low-income 4-year-olds across the state.
Carol, you mentioned the governor's office looking for expanding by doubling the amount of students, and many of the earlier discussions focused on doubling the amount of money. Is that the same thing, or can it be a little different depending on how the expansion plays out?
I think it's doubling the number of kids will probably mean doubling the amount of money. It's cliche, but the devil is kind of in the details. Is that there's a couple of different pre-K programs within the state, and the bill is seeking to kind of unify and make one unilateral program. So it's not just a $10 million to $20 million. It's going to probably equal more closer to $30 million if you add the capacity building dollars that have been requested to help build more seats, high-quality seats across the state. So the focus is to try to get as many of these low-income 4-year-olds across the state covered. And then the question is, you know, what are these low-income children, what does that exactly mean? The House version of the bill increases the income eligibility requirement to allow for more children. The Senate kept it at the current poverty level. So those are some of the details that will need to be ironed out kind of behind the scenes.
And I'll ask you the same question as I did on the transportation funding. If we had to pick one issue, one area that's going to be most contentious, does it simply come down to money, or is it something else that may be the prime issue?
I don't know that there's necessarily a contentious issue. I think we're really lucky, and I've been working on the pre-K, pilot program since before I was even at the chamber, but you know, it used to be that we spent our time lobbying on why early childhood education is so important. That message has now been received. So now it's more how much money can we get, and should we go and just expand to a few more counties across the state? Do we try to take it statewide and do it provider-based? I don't know that those issues are necessarily contentious. I'm hoping that they won't be as we go into conference, but I think it's just different types of models that we could look at moving forward, but it really is, you know, how much money do we have is going to determine what it's going to look like moving forward.
So, Kevin, I'll ask you, is it safe to say when we talk about those two priorities, transportation funding and pre-K, there really it should be a very positive outlook at this time because we're talking about when and how much, not if they're going to happen?
Absolutely. We're very encouraged and optimistic that there will indeed be a long-term transportation infrastructure funding bill passed. That's almost a given. And then the remaining question is exactly what the components are going to be. And we feel likewise with regard to the pre-kindergarten legislation. And again, we're trying to push it to go as far as possible, both in terms of eligibility, in terms of counties covered, et cetera, and in terms of funding to go beyond the current five-county pilot and the number of students that $10 million will fund. But they're certainly talking our issues and our language, and that's very encouraging. And we're down to working out some details and differences of thought between the House and the Senate.
We'll come back to some additional education issues in a little bit. Unfortunately, while the news is good on those two top priorities, another key initiative for the Chamber and our members this session has been anti-tobacco legislation to try to improve the much-needed health outcomes in our state. I'll ask either Mike Ripley or Kevin to jump in on this. Some frustration certainly in this area. We started with four components of a plan to try to reduce tobacco usage. Mike, tell about what's happened in the past couple of weeks that's kind of derailed those initiatives.
Yeah, Tom, it has been rather disappointing, not to say frustrating. I think there's one provision left, and Bill can back me up on this. The cessation, I think it may be still in the budget. Beyond that, the other 3 points that we had, repeal on the protective class of smokers, the cigarette tax increase of whether it was a buck and a half or a dollar, the dollar version that was in the budget bill in the House, and then also moving the age to from 18 to 21. Those three measures are gone at this point. But there's some discussion. The Senate did not have it in their budget for a cigarette tax increase. I think Senator Kinley doesn't believe that we need it right now, and they're kind of looking at I'm hopefully that maybe some things will change as the revenue forecast comes in next week, and maybe that will make some difference. But with the governor coming out over the past week and basically saying that he wasn't supporting a cigarette tax, I think that was rather disappointing. It doesn't leave us in good position. However, in my understanding, Representative Brown, chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, is still in our camp on this issue, and so maybe there may be some hope yet, and we'll keep working to see if there may be a way to increase the cigarette tax. At this point, it's anyone's guess that's going to play out at the end. I don't know if you have anything else, Kevin.
Well, Kevin, I would ask summary. From the you've been involved in this issue for quite a while, and certainly with the Alliance for a Healthier Indiana that the Chamber's involved with. As Mike talked about it, again, some of the opposition, the potential revenue from a cigarette tax increase got mixed into the discussion, and while that's certainly part of it, talk about the importance of how the Chamber's really tackling this from a health perspective, and it ties in directly with our Indiana Vision 2025 plan.
Absolutely, Tom. One of our goals in Indiana Vision 2025, which is our long-term economic development action plan for Indiana, is to reduce Indiana's smoking rates dramatically and in the process get us out of where we have been for a long time, and that's in the bottom 10 or the worst 10 states in terms of overall smoking rate. Worked on this issue over the summer with our colleague organizations in the Alliance for Health Indiana, which include the Hospital Association, State Medical Association, Anthem Cross, and said, what can we do from a public policy perspective to reduce smoking rates in Indiana? We came up with a four-point plan, which Mike just outlined, which is dramatically increase the tax on cigarettes, because we know cigarette smokers are price sensitive, and particularly young people who are contemplating starting smoking. If we raise the price, that raises the barrier of entry. We know that raising the age would help, the legal age of smoking, investing more in smoking cessation programs to help those who are hooked on cigarettes be able to quit, and then allow employers to be more engaged in driving a culture of not smoking by repealing the special privileges for smokers, a protected class basically for employment law purposes that was pushed through the legislature by the tobacco companies in the early 90s. And so all of this legislation that Mike's talked about is aimed towards reducing smoking rates to achieve a goal of a healthier Indiana, improve our health metrics, and make Indiana a better place for businesses to locate and grow.
Mike, while you expressed certainly the frustrations with the recent developments, obviously from your experience both as a legislator and with the chamber, are we encouraged at least somewhat by the discussions that took place, that there was some good back and forth on the issue, and that it, again, is set up for further debate in the coming years?
Well, I think you're always hopeful. I think part of the discussion was that as the bill passed the House, it was a dollar, and then there was some discussion of moving that. We heard numbers at about 60 cents. And when you hear that, I think we've kind of talked about it internally that this is not, for us, as Kevin said, it's never been about revenue. It's about moving numbers and getting people to quit smoking. So if you move it to 60 cents, which may be a possibility, and there's kind of been some a little bit of discussion about that may end up there, I'm not sure that that's really beneficial to what we're trying to accomplish, and that is we want folks to stop smoking so that we can impact our overall health rankings and then reduce costs for employers on their bottom line. And so 60 cents doesn't really help us. It means that the tobacco companies probably can discount that amount, and so you really don't get a significant. It's got to be at a dollar or more to really to drive the numbers. So while we may be there have been some discussions that have been positive, we'll have those ongoing discussions. I think that if we don't get it this year, we're going to be back at it probably most likely in the budget cycle in 2019 and look at it again and push it hard. We'll still keep working to see if we can at this point, but it's anybody's guess where it's going to fall out.
And Tom, I would add one more point. The earlier this week, we received some data that I think helps make the case for the tax rate increase and this our overall effort through the Alliance to reduce smoking. And that is some analysis from the Fairbanks Foundation that found that the state of Indiana spends nearly twice as much, over $500 million a year, to treat smoking-related diseases of people who are in the Medicaid program. They spend nearly twice as much as the state takes in cigarette tax revenue. So smoking is a losing proposition for the state of Indiana and for employers in terms of lost productivity and additional health care costs incurred to employers by their smokers versus their non-smokers.
Reminder to our members on the phone today, we'd love to hear your questions and comments. Simply hit 0101 to weigh in. We've talked about a couple of issues, first two issues headed to conference committee. Let's turn our attention to one that appears headed to a potential concurrence as early next week. That is Senate Bill 309, energy bill that Greg Ellis has been working on. We've talked about, Greg, give us the latest on that and what might take place early next week.
Sure, Tom. This past Monday and Tuesday, I spent all my time in the State House behind the scenes talking to legislators, trying to get them to vote for the bill, which was the roll call was on Tuesday. It passed 56 to 43. Some of the things that I think caused this one to be a little more narrow than we could hope for. It's just a fundamental misunderstanding. I mean, this area, utility rate making is not sexy. And I think there was a lot of confusion on the parts of the bill, specifically the net metering, and that's the solar portion, and it got the most attention. And the representatives that voted against it told us this was the part that they didn't like, or they had a neighbor that had solar energy. But anyway, it passed out of the House, 56-43. Some of the people that voted against it, we were surprised, and you guys can look for that in our legislative vote analysis. But it is headed to concurrence on Monday. Senator Hirschman had filed his concurrence, I think, Wednesday 5th.
And we expect that concurrence to take place at this point?
That is what I've heard, and I expect that it will. And I mean, we still think this is a good bill. It got tweaked, and I think the reason for the need for the concurrence, they added a portion for a summer study of schools and their ability to self-generate energy, because there was a lot of opposition from the schools that they weren't sure where they fell in this bill. One of the other things they changed was there's a grandfathering clause for people to continue to receive the full rate for 30 years. The deadline for that was originally going to be if this passed, when it went into law July 1st, they extended that deadline to December 31st. So there weren't a lot of major tweaks, but there were some tweaks.
And again, Greg, as you've discussed in the past and written about in our legislative report, this is just a kind of a good common sense step towards even more legislation to help regulate our energy costs.
Yes, and I think this illustrated the chamber's position all along, that it was a compromise, and I think we need to do this now, because if we waited, the amount of pushback on this bill for me was unbelievable, and it was all focused around the net metering, the solar, and nobody really focused on the good parts. I mean, the whole thing's good, I should say that, but on the parts that were more important to business community, such as the distributed generation, cogeneration, the location where that's been expanded. It wasn't a huge amount, but it was a step forward. Some of our members in the Energy Policy Committee meeting, noted that this was the first time in a long time that energy had been focused on, and this was a step in the right direction. And even in the end, this bill initially had the Indiana Energy Association, the Chamber, and the Indiana Manufacturers Association in support of it. IndyEC, the Indiana Industrial Energy Consumers, had opposed it for a while, and in the end, they even supported it. So at the end, the most active group, I think, was the Citizens Action Coalition that opposed it, and the Business Trade Association and community were in support of that. So I think that's what made it pass.
Greg, in your area, we also we have some water-related legislation that is headed directly to the governor. Touch on a couple of those bills and then some positive impacts there.
Well, they're consistent with our Vision 2025 plan. There was Senate Bill 416 and Senate Bill 511 in the beginning, which was the Infrastructure Assistance Fund by Senator Charbonneau. Those were converged into one bill, which was Senate Bill 416, so that will be another concurrence. And that passed unanimously in both houses. But another bill of importance that it came in late was House Bill 1519, which was Representative Van Adders and Senator Charbonneau as well, which is more of an infrastructure development zone. Under current law, you can extend natural gas infrastructure or water infrastructure out to a developing area, but wastewater wasn't allowed. So this bill allowed wastewater. Probably the more significant was the lead replacement lines, which has received a lot of attention. We initially had concerns because how it would be paid for it, who would pay for it. In the end, the utilities were involved, came to an agreement with the authors, and I think you will all be pleasantly surprised that you saved money. Some of the fixed charges that have been out there, the monthly development
charges that have been added to bills from the public utilities such as Aqua, Indiana American, you should save thousands of dollars. So I think this is a good bill, and it's probably the costs are allocated more appropriately than they were before.
Thank you, Greg.
And
Bill Waltz, we've had a couple of... Yes, please.
Pardon the interruption. We do have one question from the audience, and this comes from Dan Cannon. Please go ahead, sir.
Hi. First of all, thanks, everybody, for being here this morning. Appreciate it very much. House Bill 1133, the bill's calling the Airbnb. As I've been watching that, obviously there was an amendment that came on that made that more palatable, and that amendment got pulled. There seems to be a lot of, not contentions, maybe not the right word, but differences of opinion. Where do you see that going this session?
Well, it is past the House. I think it's back to close to, if not identical to, the version that passed the House. There was an attempt, as you point out, Dan, to allow some local government control and input through a permitting process. That amendment was then removed, as I understand, before the final vote. It's entirely possible that bill, if there is some differences, will be concurred upon and sent on to the governor. And so that seems to be where that bill is headed.
Thank you.
That may not be the answer you wanted to hear, but that's the status.
I appreciate that.
Well, and Dan, I would just add, we've had a Council of State Chambers meeting last fall, and that Kevin and I and several others attended. This was a prime issue. A lot of states and others and cities that are taking up such legislation about state and local control of items related to the sharing economy, whether it's Airbnb or Uber, Lyft, other things. So I think an issue we're going to continue to hear a lot more about.
No doubt, as technology changes, you know, a lot of new issues that we're not even thinking of today are going to surface. But obviously, our concern comes back to home rule and local rule, and what is a business, what is not a business, and the big issue is also not only that, but the innkeeper's tax. Who's collecting that? Is anybody collecting that? And is that a fair competition to the entities that have built structures and paid millions of dollars and collect those fees and pass them on appropriately?
Yep.
Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Bill Waltz, we've had a couple references to the budget forecast, the revenue forecast. I'm sorry. That's coming up next week. What is the date on that? And not that I expect you to pull out a crystal ball and tell us what they're going to come up with, but just talk about the importance of that. It's always critical in these last few weeks leading into the final weeks of session.
Thanks, Tom. Well, there's a reason you're coming to me last, I guess, and it's a good one that there's not been tons of things happening.
I think what you should call it saving the best for last is how you should put it.
Well, I wish that were the case, but a good bit of inactivity in my area. The forecast, though, I believe is going to be Wednesday scheduled. And haven't gotten – they're usually very tight-lipped about what they expect. There may be some indications in the way that the fiscal folks talk about possibilities and potential changes in the budget, but I don't get the sense that they think there's going to be a lot of additional revenue. You know, it's there's not that much that has changed or you know, maybe to be forecasted differently than what occurred in December. So if there are increases, and there could be, I'm purely guessing now or speculating that they would not be tremendous amounts of money. You know, the pre-K funding I've sort of also guessed is one of those items that if there is some more money that the Senate's been very reserved in expanding any, you know, providing anything additional or even what the governor and the House wants on that front. But perhaps it could come in that form if there's a little more money made available. You know, the budget, the general operating fund allocations in the House and Senate budgets are very, very similar. There's not a lot of dispute going on there. The higher ed, you know, one of the bigger numbers that's a little bit different is that the Senate decided to provide some more funding and bonding authority for higher ed construction projects that the House did not do. So if you're looking hard for some differences, that might be one that could get pointed to.
Either way, we're looking at 2 years, about $32 billion, correct?
Yeah, right at that. They're about $700 million off, I think. The difference is the Senate spends a little more money right now. But
when, for you, Bill, that's just like change that you find in your couch, right?
It's not a big percentage, not a big number percentage-wise, and that kind of fluctuation it occurs. So,
Bill, I know you previously, I believe we talked a little bit about Internet Sales Tax Collection Bill, and I saw an update I think you're going to have on that in our legislative report, but can you tell our listeners a little bit about that legislation?
Yeah, there was a bill that I talked about on this call previously that Senator Kinley authored, and to his credit, it was providing a mechanism for the state to collect sales tax on online transactions from the e-tailers, I guess they're referred to as folks that do not have a physical presence in the state but transact a lot of business with Indiana residents. That bill was actually heard in the Ways and Means Committee and then not voted out. Interestingly enough, there was a lot of support for it, bipartisan support, and I'm thinking that it might just be a reminder by the chairman of Ways and Means to his counterpart in the Senate, Senator Kinley, that he also has control of some bills. And so, and I say that because this happened simultaneously with the Senator Kinley and the Senate making some pretty substantial changes to some of the chairman of the Ways and Means and the House's initiatives, most notably the 1002, the road funding bill. And, you know, other items, including, you know, some of the pre-K and funding. So perhaps that was just a little bit of a message and that bill could ultimately be revived yet and appear in another bill. It certainly would be what we will be advocating for since we think it was a positive step. So hope it's not actually dead yet.
Excellent. Mark Lawrence, let's talk about some of our technology priorities that the Chamber and the Indiana Technology and Innovation Council came up with this year. Greg mentioned some misunderstanding regarding Senate Bill 309 and the net metering. I understand we also had some maybe lack of clarity regarding open data and the management performance of. Talk about how that was kind of rectified.
For those people who are in the audience who enjoy watching Senate debate and contention, this is a really good week to be there. There's a committee hearing on House Bill 1470, which is basically codifying the currently ongoing management and performance hub that was created by executive order 3 years ago. It is a data repository sort of where, not a repository, it's a, I think a depot where they import different data from state agencies, map it with other data for specific projects that are of use to policymakers and finding out issues that would be of importance for, you know, a lot of different entities, including the legislature. So 1470 was in a committee hearing last week, and it was pretty bizarre, the hearing, because they really, the types of questions came totally from a perspective of protection of confidential information and, you know, the black helicopter types, and they'll know too much about me and so forth. And the committee members in the committee, the Senate Commerce and Technology Committee, were not listening to the answers, so they didn't want to hear the answers that were being given. So at the very last moment of that, and it was kind of rushed hearing towards the end because an hour-long hair-braiding deregulation bill was being heard beforehand, but they ended up making it, the committee vote was for a study committee on this. We need to study this further, which means code for we need to learn more about that. But so it came to the floor, and on second reading amendment, Senator Hirschman, who is managing the bill, is running the bill in the Senate, he wanted to bring back the bill because he was trying to get answers to the bill and so forth. So on a second reading amendment going in, which ended up going back in, the original bill language went in, and it was passed, actually, the 34 to 14. So it'll go to conference committee. There are still some things to work out on that bill, but it was one of those classic cases where questions about an issue that legislators might have known a little bit about but didn't know truly what the impact, what the intention was of the bill and all that. So it was interesting to see. We believe it'll end up being an issue, but I think more important than that is what's in House Bill 1001 on the budget of it, because we think it should be around $7.5-8 million or so a year, and right now it's at $3 million. So right now it just needs more resources. So 1470 would be nice to get it right, but it's more important to get the budget amount right so this can move forward.
And, Mark, the important part of that bill, again, is what we're really saying is government has to take an analytical approach and work together and gather the information that's out there to just make better, more informed decisions going forward.
That's right. And the potential for this is really vast. And Indiana has actually taken a leadership position on this for a statewide database that aggregates or uses agency data, which oftentimes they operate in silos. So an example of use would be the opioid crisis that's going on in many communities around the state. Well, they can assemble police data, they can do health data, other things to help really get at some of the root of the issue of how they can problem solve.
So it's either take that leadership position and continue to be a leader or definitely fall behind.
Right, that's correct. And there are a couple other things that are in House Bill 1001, too, that I might just go on. One is on the venture capital tax credit transferability. Basically, the governor supports it. The House supported it in the original version. The Senate seems to have a problem with the transferability of that. We're going to continue to work on that to see if we can get that as an outcome. We're not using full amount of the tax credit, and we think that some vehicle to allow and encourage additional VC dollars in Indiana would be a really good thing, and this is one way to do that. Another big part of this, too, is what is in the Major Moves Trust Fund right now, which I believe is called the Next Generation Trust Fund. They want to create, we're basically at $500 million from the road funding, and it's not supposed to go below that amount, but right now it's invested in very, very conservative investments. And one of the aspects that the Senate took out that we'd like to see put back in is to put together an investment policy committee to look at, say, half of the money, $250 million, to consider investing those in either funds that invest in Indiana businesses or maybe directly invest in Indiana businesses. That's for about $250 million. That's really important. And another part is better connectivity with other parts of the world. And the Indianapolis Airport, which is truly Indiana's airport, they initiated direct flights to San Francisco, which have done very, very well. Several years ago, there was a backstop put in place. It was about $1.5 million that the Indiana Economic Development Corporation put in for the airlines to start on that route. It's worked out to be very encouraging. They've added more routes. We have that same opportunity with Europe and perhaps direct flights to London. And right now, our airport is in contention for the next round of direct flights to Europe. And we believe this could be a difference maker. So we'd like to see that restored back to $5 million a year as a backstop for that.
Just as it's been interesting to see a number of announcements from throughout the state at a variety of airports about more direct flights, expanded service. There seems to be a strong momentum throughout Indiana regarding our air infrastructure, and this is just one step to hope to continue that.
Mark, I know that several of our listeners are from Northwest Indiana. Could you talk a little bit about the South Shore and the double tracking and where that stands?
Sure, great. Thank you, Kevin, for bringing that up. This is House Bill 1144, which is basically double tracking the South Shore Railway, which goes basically from St. Joseph County to Chicago, and also there's a spur that goes south through Lake County and south there to, I believe, it's Lowell, mm-hmm. I think. So. This is a priority of Governor Holcomb, one that we ended up supporting because it really truly has a large regional impact on this, and it creates districts where nearby the stations where they can create additional funding to help and revenue streams to pay for the double tracking of that. It's a very, very strong economic development bill, and it was that ended up being passing quite a bit. It was 48-0 from the Senate. So I think that the differences that were in the Senate, they're going to be worked out in conference committee, but I think that's another big plus for this session that we can say in terms of an infrastructure improvement.
Thank you.
Carol Auslander, let's turn back to some additional education issues. We informed listeners and our legislative report readers earlier in the session about the Senate defeating a bill to appoint the superintendent of public instruction. After a little bit of maneuvering, that seems to have changed. Tell us again the latest on that.
That's correct. The appointed superintendent bill this week has risen from the ashes like the phoenix. So if you're into parliamentary procedure or legislative rules, this is kind of an interesting one to watch because the bill in the Senate, like you said, Tom, was decisively defeated on the Senate floor by a vote of, I think it was 26-23. And the Senate rules state that the bill can only, at that point in time, the House immediately passed their version of the bill, which moved over, which was substantially similar. It wasn't identical language, but was very, very, very similar, had the same components into the bill. So the Senate rules stated after the Senate attorneys looked at this for quite a few many days, stated that they could look at the bill and they could consider the bill if it were substantially different. So Senator Long sent the bill to Rules Committee, which typically is where bills go to die. But in this case, it was sent to Rules Committee so that Senator Long could kind of control the process as chairman of the Rules Committee and immediately amended the bill, much to the angst of the Senate Democrats, to change some specific provisions in the bill, specifically making it, instead of going into effect in 2021, pushing it out to 2025, as well as putting some residency and educational experience requirements, both of which the chamber did not really support, but we understood that this was the process that had to go through to keep the bill moving. The bill was heard on third reading for final vote this week, and we had to switch 5 Republican votes from no's to yeses, which is a pretty big number for an issue that people have kind of taken sides on a lot already, but we were able to move those votes. We had 2 legislators that were out that day. We were trying to kind of really count votes and count seats up until the very last minute, but the bill did pass 28-20. It will be dissented upon, and we will be discussing this in conference committee. The real question is, and we haven't been able to get a good answer, is can we change any of those provisions? Can we move it back to 2021? Can we take out the residency requirements and the education experience? We want to have the best person possible to be appointed to our superintendent. And if that best person lives in Dallas, Texas, then we should, we want the best person. So I think right now the chamber is leaning, if we had to choose one provision to take out, we probably want to take out the education residency requirements and push it back to 2025, but we're hoping we can try to get those negotiated, both of those provisions negotiated in conference. It is a governor priority bill. He's been tweeting about it on social media this week, so we're going to have him weigh in on this as well.
This is a longstanding policy position of the chambers as well. There should be vertical alignment between the governor and the head of the Department of Education, just like there is with all other state agencies.
Carol, in addition, certainly an issue over the last couple of years has been iStep. Now we're talking about iLearn. What are we seeing as far as not only when iLearn might take effect, but kind of the form that it'll take place in?
Absolutely. I still need to learn what iLearn stands for, so maybe by the time session ends, I'll have that acronym down.
Well, you know, that's one of those acronyms that kind of stands on its own. We know those letters all mean something, but just put it together and iLearn and everybody's happy.
Well, the bill did pass out of the House through the Senate and passed through the Senate this week. This is one of those bills that I think will look substantially different after conference committee. But basically what it is doing is it is a bill had passed last year, 1395, which sunset the iStep exam as we know it this summer. And we need to push that back. The iStep alternatives panel that met for 9 months over the summer and the fall had many national experts that came to speak to them that said it would take a minimum of 2 years to develop a test and have it ready to go for our students. And so the main provision of this is going to push that sunset provision to 2019, which really will need to take place. There's been a lot of discussion on whether we should decouple teacher accountability for this iStep test. The chamber has been pushing back against this very strongly. We don't feel that the test is flawed. It's been the administration of the test that's been flawed, and teacher accountability should remain in place. If we feel that if we lose teacher accountability moving forward, we will never get it back, and that's a very strong priority for the chamber. Some of the provisions that are in the bill is that it's moving to one testing window and moving that testing window till the end of the school year so that there's more time for teachers to fit in a year's worth of curriculum, to be done by end of April, early May, as opposed to testing them in February or March where they wouldn't have enough time to cram all that in, and it removes the dead time upon completion of the standardized test at the end of the year where, you know, those are not items that are going to be tested on. So that'll be moving forward. There's a lot of questions as to whether we keep end of course assessments and whether we keep with the CQE exams or we move to a SAT exam. We have the House that believes one way, we've got the Senate that believes certain things, we have the Department of Education that believes certain things, and so we're trying to find some common ground, which has not been easy on this bill, but hopefully in conference committee we'll come up with something.
Kevin, a question via Twitter on a non-legislative issue, but one that you're well versed in as not only chamber president, but chairman of the Hoosier Voices for I-69. Some information meetings going on currently about the last leg of I-69 connecting Martinsville to Indianapolis.
Mm-hmm.
Give them some brief information on kind of where that stands.
Recently, NDOT completed and released the, they call it an environmental study, on Section 6. Of I-69, which is the last section to be constructed. It's between the south edge of Martinsville all the way up to I-465 in Marion County. The term environmental impact study is a bit of a misnomer because they're not just studying the impact on the environment, you know, bats and wetlands and that kind of thing. But they're also looking at the economic impact. They're looking at how many homes or businesses have to be displaced, what's the overall cost, et cetera. So it's really a comprehensive study. It's required by the federal government, and that has now occurred, frankly, earlier or faster than we expected. To refresh the listeners, the NDOT has chosen among a multitude of different routes to get from Martinsville to Indianapolis to stay on Highway 37 and come up Highway 37 all the way up to Epler Avenue, which is maybe a half a mile south of I-465, and at that point veer off of Highway 37 and go to the west a little bit and build a new interchange, because there's a whole lot of businesses and activity at the current intersection of 37 and 465, and they decided rather than try to buy out all those businesses and disrupt all that, that they would swing to the west just a little bit, build a new interchange. So all that to say that things are moving along with the planning for Section 6, but we need to remember that there's currently no funding to build Section 6, and that the estimate in that environmental impact study is, I believe, in excess of $1 billion. And so that's why the funding, the long-term funding in House Bill 1002 is critically important to be able to finish Section 6 of I-69, as well as, you know, fund other projects that have been talked about, including taking some of our existing interstates from four lanes to six lanes. So we're very pleased that that progress has been made. The environmental impact study has been released, and now NDOT is holding public hearings on that and environmental study to seek input, and they may make some tweaks and changes to the route and the plan as they go along. The other thing that environmental impact study included, which is critically important, is for all the roads that currently cross Highway 37, which ones are they going to build interchanges on, which ones are they going to build overpasses or underpasses and not have access to the highway as they currently do. And obviously that's very important to individuals and businesses along that route. And so that's all been laid out in this study and as well.
As we close out in our final 2 minutes here, a reminder to listeners, legislators typically have until April 29th during the long session to complete their work, and they still could go that long, but they're planning to wrap up within the next 2 weeks, April 21st target date, due to a Fire Department Instructors Conference, a national international conference here in Indianapolis. There'll be about 30,000 plus visitors taking up most of the hotel rooms during the last week of April. So that's why we've seen a bit of an accelerated schedule this last second half of the session. Kevin, I'll give you the closing word, and anyone else who wants to weigh in. As we've demonstrated during this last hour, not a lot of contention, just some details that need to be worked out. Is that a fair assessment of what we expect to see the next 2 weeks?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think when the dust settles on the 2017 session of the General Assembly, we're going to find that a number of chamber priorities, a number of pieces of legislation that tie and further advance Indiana Vision 2025 will have been enacted, and we will continue our economic growth and our positioning of Indiana as one of the best business climates in the country and one of the best places in the country, if not the world, to grow businesses and raise families.
Thank you, Kevin, and the entire Chamber of Government Affairs team for your continued excellent work on behalf of our members and investors. A couple reminders, do look for your legislative report this afternoon. I'll have additional details not only on the bills we discussed today, but additional legislation that impacts your business. And also, as we our final question about I-69, a reminder that the Chamber and Hoosier Voices is hosting an I-69 Regional Summit on May 5th. There'll be a link in to a follow-up email to today's call with more information on that. It's a day-long event looking at the economic development impacts of Interstate 69 and how communities can take advantage of that. Thank you for your participation and for your support of the Indiana Chamber. Have a wonderful Friday and weekend.
Thank you all for your attention. This concludes today's conference call. All participants may now disconnect.